We have two cases scheduled for argument this morning. We understand counsel in those cases have announced ready and declared the time that we should take for your argument. That being the case, we'll call Vineyard Village Limited and Vineyard Village MSV LLC versus Univest Properties, Inc. Mr. Kelly, before you begin, let me just take a moment to recognize some distinguished guests in our audience. We have five members of the Rotary Study Group Exchange from Mexico. Among those five, we have, a lawyer, a law student, an accountant, and a doctor, a biologist. Have I covered all of the professions represented? Okay. Well, we want to welcome you to the United States and to the Second Court of Appeals of Texas. Would you all stand, those of you who are here visiting from the from Mexico? I don't think that. Okay. Okay. Well, I thought maybe we needed an interpreter for my recognition.
I think they heard I was coming.
So okay, well, they've been recognized. When they do show up, we'll make sure.
Bill, there was a very impressive oral argument given.
Okay, start the clock running.
May it please the Court, D. Kelly for Vineyard Village Appellant. Your Honors, this is a de novo review of a summary judgment ruling regarding a contract construction. Fairly straightforward appeal. There are two issues primarily before the court. One, their construction is wrong, ours is right. Second one, whether you agree or disagree with an interpretation, there are fact issues presented at the trial court level and ambiguities in the contract that best left this construction for the fact finder at the time of trial. What's the case about? By the way, this presentation is not mine, so you can disregard this for the purposes of my argument.
I'm impressed already.
I am too, and I'm anxious to see it. This was a shopping center development where my client owned the entire property and then sold the out parcels, which you've seen in the briefs, the pad sites, to Univest. And to ensure the parcels were developed harmoniously and with proper access, the parties entered into a reciprocal easement and operating agreement, which we will call the REA for the purposes of this argument. Now, development consistent with the REA required nothing between the parties. So, in other words, the site plan that was attached to the REA set forth the development plan, and any development consistent with that site plan required no communication between the parties. But Univest sought to change its development plan and sought relief from the site plan with the Euless City Council and brought that before them without contacting my client. And when we learned of it, we objected. And then we immediately brought suit to stop the planned development that was before the Euless City Council. What was the change? There were four pad sites shown on the site plan for Univest outparcel. Now, the contract, the REA, allowed a three pad site development, but the question that came before the trial court was whether or not the three pad sites had any size limitation and whether or not that was a minor, major, or some level of revision to the site plan that required my client's consent. And if I may approach, I want to at least make this graphical as important. See, I did bring one problem. This was the original site plan attached to the REA. And you'll see the out parcel I describe as the pad sites, 1, 2, 3, 4 pad sites highlighted in yellow. That is the only matter that's at issue in this investigation, this little piece of property, and those four pad sites. What happened, what they took to the Euless City Council, this is Clerk's Record 301, is they changed it without notice to my client. And this is what they changed it to. Here are the four pad sites. On the previous map, you'll see this portion of the development is not on there, but it's not relevant to this dispute. So you take this piece, it's right here. This is the out parcel, and here's how the four pad sites, 1, 2, 3, 4, became three. And the easiest way to see this, is that a revision? Well, certainly it's a revision. Is it a minor? Is it a major? It's certainly minor revision. I can call it a major revision. The problem is the REA does not even say what happens with regard to a major revision. All it says is with a minor revision, you must seek owner's consent. It is undisputed that never happened.
The REA also says that the development must be in substantially the manner set forth on the site plan. That's in the record 165. That's where the REA is. Did the term pad site as used in the REA contain any size limitations with regard to that development? Certainly, as it relates to that site plan, there are size limitations you can see on there. We believe pad site is a term of art in the real estate industry that denotes certain size limitations because there is no size limitation in the REA with regard to those developments. We believe our construction of the agreement is proper and they should have sought our consent with regard to these changes. At the very least, we think the terms pad site and the consent provisions were ambiguous. Trial court did not fully understand those without regard to evidence that he heard, and I'll talk about that, at a temporary injunction hearing just a month before the summary judgment, and made the determination without stating it in his judgment that it was unambiguous and construed the contract in favor of Univest.
Was ambiguity pled in the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor. It wasn't pled in the original pleading. There was a supplemental pleading presented to the trial court prior to the summary judgment hearing, and I'll give you the exact site. It's in the supplemental clerk's record at page 86.
If these terms are so important, why were they left undefined?
That's obviously a question brought to my attention. I think pad site is a term of art, and that is a definition. In my view, pad site is a limitation on the size of the development. But I think the terms work harmoniously, Your Honor. I believe that consent is required. Therefore, if you exceed the pad site showing on the site plan or the limitation shown on that site plan, it works harmoniously. You must seek consent. The reason they didn't seek our consent, they were concerned we wouldn't give it. If we give it, they go forward. If we don't give it, then they have to find another way. They either have to revise it to get our consent, something that will satisfy the owner of the back lots, because all this is about access, all about sight lines. That's why you put limitations. Or you don't get it, and then you have to take some other measure, file suit, whatever it might be. But I do think they are defined and they're harmonious in the way they work together. Question comes to my mind, why did the court take the action that it did? Well, the court, in its judgment, if you look at the judgment, at the record size 825, it's strictly a judgment of compliance. All the judge says is you complied with several other terms in the REA. That's all it says. It says you complied with the space limitations, the parking requirements, the dumpster requirements, things of that nature. Never says anything about the pad site limitation. Never says anything about consent. In fact, it is completely silent. It doesn't say that withholding consent with regard to this change site plan would have been unreasonable. The trial court judgment does not say that. What the trial court judgment does is read those terms out entirely. And that's my problem. You cannot render terms of a contract meaningless. They have to mean something. The trial court's judgment just says you complied with 456, and I'm reading out 123. You just can't do it under any terms of construction of that contract. And why did the court take the action? I think I said that a minute ago. I believe, and if you look at the record history of this case, there was suit filed by my client. So in actuality, the defendant counterclaimant won the case. And immediately, a temporary injunction hearing took place. And it was 30 days later. The court heard lots of evidence at that temporary injunction hearing. He heard disputed evidence over all the things we're talking about. And I think he formed opinions, as any trial court would. And he made a determination on the temporary injunction. What happened is Univest, before the temporary injunction hearing, filed a motion for summary judgment. Much of the evidence heard at the temporary injunction hearing is not even in the summary judgment record. And that made it to that summary judgment record, I think, raises fact issues as relates to the questions for the court. I just think the trial court, as could be expected, heard the temporary injunction evidence and made the determination on temporary injunction that he carried forward on the summary judgment. What he should have done, in our opinion, is he should have set it for trial and let the fact finder make the same determinations that he made at the temporary injunction hearing. They were so close together, I think he had an idea of what he wanted to do. Now, you can almost see it in his comments from the bench that are not only cited by us but also by them. I think you'll see at page 13 of our brief where he starts talking about what does pad site mean? I can't quite figure it out. And then he talks later in a citation they make in their brief at page 8 where he starts talking about the size of the buildings. I can't understand that. What does the size of the buildings mean? This is all this temporary injunction hearing where he's confused about these issues and asking questions. Well, he figured it out in his own mind what it should be. Unfortunately, that shouldn't have been the proper ruling on summary judgment.
Well, we don't have any findings of fact or conclusions of law here. I assume none were requested. Is that correct?
There were findings requested in the final judgment as related to attorney's fees that triggered off this.
But not as to pad site, whether the withholding of consent was reasonable or not. Whether it was a major or minor revision, so we presume that the trial court must have ultimately concluded that all of those fact issues in favor of his judgment.
The trial court made findings, specific findings on declaratory relief, that the judgment that was presented to him, he signed. I think he had an obligation to make those findings. Otherwise, they can't be presumed that they were. Consent was never given. Consent is required. Either he must find it's unreasonable to withhold consent, or he must find that consent was given. And that request, if you look at the pleadings that were submitted to the court, that he was making his determinations based on, the pleadings, the live pleadings of these parties, they didn't ask for any of those rulings to be considered by the trial court. In other words, to assume that the trial court made findings that were never requested, I don't think can be made in this particular case. You look at the live pleadings that went to him.
Was there evidence before the court other than from your client about the pad site size? And as I recall, he made a distinction between at the rear of the property and the front of the property. Was there any other expert testimony or to the effect that pad site is a term of art and it means this?
And I want to get to the evidentiary issue, by the way. I think some of Mr. Collins, the expert on our side of the case, did get into the record, even though he made some rulings on evidence that struck much of that evidence. But some of it got into the summary judgment record that he considered. That is the only evidence on a limitation. I think consistently Univest took the position, the contract says this, we complied, that's it. It has no size limitation, therefore there is none. And if that's evidence, that's evidence. But that's what they said. They never took a position on pad site. They do take a position in their brief to this court, though, for the first time, on page 26. They say pad site is defined as an area of a land for development, period. It has no special meaning. It's just you could take the word pad away from it, and it still had the same meaning, site. It's just an area of land for development. It has nothing to do. I think, first of all, I do think pad site's a term of art. I think it's a term of art in several contexts, in energy context, in the real estate context, and I think anyone in that business would tell you that. We had one expert that told you that. Also, in the context of this particular case, these pad sites were set forth on a site plan which required consent before it could be changed, any minor revision. So in this particular context, I think they have a definition as well, just by the fact the way they were set out in the site plan.
Well, did it take permission to change from 4 to 3 as allowed under the contract?
Absolutely not, and I think that's straightforward. They could change to 3.
And they did.
And they did. And we don't have any complaint about the fact they changed from 4 to 3. It's just the size of the 3. And the fact they didn't seek our consent. I think the consent provision is absolutely critical because that's how the owner protects himself. Because if you set something out there that he doesn't agree and some minor revision to the site plan, they have to come to you. And if they come to you and you don't like it, then you don't give consent. Now, they may have a process to have a court determine that it's unreasonable to withhold consent, but they need to go through that process, or they work it out with you, which is what happens most of the time. And that's the ultimate protection of the owner who owns all of that real estate behind that little front parcel. I want to get briefly to the restrictive covenant issue, and I think this is very important, too, because half their briefs spent on the fact that our definitions, our construction, is restricting the free use of land. I want to turn the court's attention, and we don't mention this in our brief, and I apologize, but I do want to turn the court's attention to the REA at paragraph 29, where it says specifically on that issue, the rule of strict construction shall not apply to this agreement. The provisions of this agreement shall be given a reasonable construction so that the intention of the parties to confer commercially usable rights of enjoyment is carried out. So in other words, the parties agreed that a reasonable interpretation should be given to this contract. Strict construction rules do not apply. The whole argument made by Univest in that context really is inapplicable to this situation. But even if it was, and this court's opinion, which is cited repeatedly in Dygard, I think it's so factually distinctive, I don't think it has any application in this case. That was a residential piece of land. This is commercial. That case had to do with a distant grantor. This has a direct negotiation between the parties with regard to this particular development. And we're not limiting their use in any way, shape, or form, other than to what we agree to. They still have the free use of that property. They just need to use it in conformity with the party's agreement. And the cases, Dygard and others, talk about limiting use, perhaps entire uses. And that is a alienation of property. You cannot limit use entirely. We're not limiting it. We're just limiting it to the agreement that the parties made.
Your position is that even a minor change, however minor, had to seek your permission. It's just that with a minor change, you couldn't unreasonably withhold that consent.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that your position?
Absolutely. And what is a minor change? It wasn't defined. Is that an ambiguity in and of itself? I think so. What is a major revision versus minor? Well, the contract doesn't even speak to what a major revision is, which I think this clearly is a major revision. But assuming that minor incorporates major, they would have needed to seek our consent. Now, if the owner did not think consent was necessary or provided it, then that's the end of the story.
You know, I want to correcting myself here. I ask you about trial court findings of fact and conclusions, and this is a summary judgment proceeding, and ordinarily those you wouldn't find those in a summary judgment proceeding. But I guess the question I have is why couldn't the trial court, in your view, have found as a matter of law that this was a minor revision, that the pad site changes are consistent with the contract and so forth?
I still think it's the same argument, Your Honor. I'd look to their pleading at record 102. Their pleading asks for specific types of relief. Nowhere do they ask the court to make that determination as a matter of law. If they did and he didn't put it in his judgment, perhaps you could make that inference. But they do not make that request. They ask for specific declaratory relief. If they had asked, and I looked at this many times over, trying to find out why didn't they not do that, well, whatever happened at the trial court level, they did not ask for that type of relief in the declaratory relief. This judgment is not a breach of contract judgment. There's no finding of a breach of contract in that judgment by the trial court. And there's only very specified rulings, and they're all things that were specifically, they claim, asked for in their pleading. And without a pleading to support that kind of finding, I don't think the court can inferentially have made that determination. And this is a declaratory judgment case, and I think that's the law as relates to declaratory judgments.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, I'm David Johnson here on behalf of Appalese, Univest, and Yorkshire. This case is a case about a landowner's right to fully own his property. It's that bundle of sticks. It's that bundle of rights we all learned about in property class in law school. Now, in Texas, the fundamental public policy is that because of the encouragement of marketability of real estate, because of the not wanting to have dead hands control real estate, and because of the unexpected uses for property in the future, Texas courts have consistently said we're going to strictly construe restrictive covenants and only enforce them if they are clearly worded. Now, this is a case where we have expressed restrictive covenants. We have expressed limitations on size. And my client produced competent summary judgment evidence that we complied with all of those express restrictions. That's not what this case is about. This case is about Vineyard wanting to imply alleged ambiguous, unclear restrictions on us. Their best case is the restrictions are unclear, ambiguous, and we need a fact-finding. Well, that is 180 degrees different than the law in Texas, as recognized by this court in the Dygard opinion, an opinion that Justice Casey sat on. I would like to talk about two things today, and that is the correct construction of restrictive covenants in Texas and the express language of the restrictive covenants in the case, showing this court how they are not ambiguous in any respect. The Supreme Court has consistently held that restrictive covenants are strictly construed and ambiguities are found in favor of the free, loose, and land.
What about the language pointed out by Mr. Kelly in the contract about reasonable interpretation as opposed to strict construction?
Talking about the layout of the property in paragraph 4?
Well, I think he quoted something on page 29 of the REA about no...
Paragraph 29.
That was never raised in the trial court, for the first thing. That was never raised in any of the summary judgment pleadings. That was never disputed in the trial court. Secondly, I'm not aware of any trial court or any case in Texas that would say that that sort of provision somehow trumps the common law strict construction of restrictive covenants.
But counsel, in construing the contract and giving it meaning, aren't we bound to construe it in accordance with the manner that parties agreed that we should construe it? Are you saying that we just ignore this provision completely?
Well, I think that provision is somewhat similar to the Texas Property Code provision that says that under a residential community restriction that the court is to liberally construe the agreement. That's in the Texas Property Code dealing with residential developments.
Now, Mr. Johnson, this isn't a residential development, is it?
That's correct, sir. It is not a residential development, and therefore the common law would apply in this case.
So the property code has nothing to do with this case in terms of...
That's correct. That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
Now, what is it about this provision that essentially says the rule of strict construction shall not apply, the provisions of the agreement shall be given a reasonable construction? What is it about that principle as applied to this case that your position abhors, so to speak? I mean, why is it that you oppose application of that type of construction to this case?
Even if you apply a liberal construction, we still win. This agreement is not ambiguous, and I'm planning to show the court how it's not ambiguous in any respect. I was simply saying that with regard to the Texas Property Code provision, it's a similar analogy in that this court in Dygard looked at that and said, yeah, you have the statute that says liberal interpretation, but what does that mean? And the court said, well, we still apply the rules of strict construction in the context of an ambiguity. If there's an ambiguity, it is favored in favor of free use. In the context of here, you can say, well, the rules of strict construction with regard to how you interpret the language, i.e., contract construction rules may apply. But at the end result of that, if you still have an ambiguity, that provision does not state that you then have a fact issue that goes to a jury. It doesn't say that at all. And this court has held in Dygard that if you have an ambiguity, it is implied in favor of free use.
In Dygard, though, I don't believe either party claimed that the contract was ambiguous. But am I correct about that?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. But, I mean, the rules of construction wouldn't change. It would be the same whether the parties pled or argued ambiguity or did not.
But so when we have two parties looking at the same terminology and both parties are saying it means something different.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have an ambiguity, do we not?
No, Your Honor. Just because two parties say that something's just because one party says it's not ambiguous and the other party says it is ambiguous doesn't mean that there's an ambiguity. This court, as a matter of law, and the trial court, as a matter of law, looks at the agreement and determines whether it's ambiguous. Just because the parties may disagree doesn't affect that.
Well, both interpretations are reasonable. Seems to me that certainly gives rise to an ambiguity.
Well, if this court determines that you have more than one reasonable interpretation, then you may have an ambiguity. The issue then becomes, what do you do with it? Do you say there's a fact issue and send it back for a jury trial and say a jury can listen to all this parole evidence and imply a restriction on my client? Or do you say, well, there's an ambiguity. In Texas, if you're going to have a restriction, you better make it clear, because that's what the Texas Supreme Court has said over and over and over. You only enforce a restriction if it's clear. So their best day in court is, it's ambiguous. Well, that doesn't get you anywhere.
But let me ask a question about their drawing and your last point here. Is it your position that you did not need to ask their, get their consent for a minor change, or is it your position that this wasn't a change because it was in conformance with the REA, your three pad and how it turned out?
Right. I'll answer that question right now. Your Honor, with regard to this layout right here, three pad configuration, which would be right here, this is the original pad site plan to the REA. Shows three pads. We wanted to and thought it was best to develop it as these three properties right here, three pads, and we have the express right to do that. Okay. So what about this first sentence?
So your position is going to be we didn't need to seek consent because
correct.
We didn't make a change. This is in conformance with what we were allowed to do.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Okay.
But it's this first sentence becomes irrelevant because we have the right to go to a three-pad configuration.
I understand.
And there isn't a site plan that shows a three-pad configuration. So we're not, our three-pad configuration doesn't relate to the site plan. So this first sentence becomes irrelevant as to us. Now, it still has meaning. It has meaning because if we chose to do a four-pad option, it has meaning. It still has meaning because their property back here in the back, they still have to do it substantially in compliance with the site plan and minor consent and all that kind of stuff. But with regard to us, because in the second sentence of that paragraph, it says all these pad sites right up here in front can be laid out differently than the site plan, so long as there's sufficient parking. And that contains sufficient parking is important because that is a size limitation. That's a size limitation. You can't build it to have the entire property line because you have to have sufficient parking. So why would you have that express limitation on size and then have this fuzzy pad site definition? And the next sentence is even more specific. It deals solely with Univest property. It says we can build it in three or four pad sites. If there's three pad sites, it doesn't say we have to be in conforming with the site plan because that would make no sense because the site plan doesn't have a three-pad configuration. But it says what do we have to do? It has to be separated by 100 feet, another size limitation. The three buildings we have to be separated by by 100 feet each. We did that.
Now, you said in your brief numerous times that their only complaint, they admitted that their only complaint was the depth of the building. And I never really read where they said that exactly.
Well, there was temporary injunction sworn testimony by their client, and which was then attached to a supplemental response and was part of the summary judgment record.
He said all he wanted was it turned.
Correct.
And from that, you got, or I gathered that from that, you thought your position became they're only concerned about the depth.
Well, that's what they said. That's what he said. I said, are you concerned?
Read that. Okay.
I mean, are you concerned about the fact that it's a retail and not restaurant? Well, no, that doesn't bother me. Were you concerned that we developed three instead of four? No, that doesn't bother me. Well, are you concerned about the size of the building? That's 16,000 square feet. If it's turned a certain location, no, I guess that wouldn't bother me either. So the only thing he in his testimony said, well, it's just the width of the building, and the reason is he says it's because these line of sights that go into this back part of the development. Of course, the problem is there's no evidence to substantiate that. In fact, the only evidence in the record is that the lines of sight going to this back parcel was increased by us building a three-pad configuration. So the only basis for his understanding was completely wrong. So we had the absolute right to build three buildings as long as they're 100 feet apart, and we didn't need to seek consent because the first sentence becomes irrelevant in that circumstance as it regards to us. It doesn't become meaningless. It doesn't become irrelevant in all circumstances. Now,
Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir.
What is the definition of a pad site in this litigation as far as your client is concerned?
If you look at the REA.
Paragraph 4.
It says in sentence 2, all the pad sites fronting 121.
Yes, sir.
All these areas of development fronting 121 are pad sites. Okay? If you look at this parcel right here, that's a Vineyard Village parcel, over 13,000 square feet. This parcel right here, a Vineyard Village parcel, that is a pad site, over 12,000 square feet. That's what is described in the parties' agreement, not this 9,000 square foot limitation.
All right. So when the parties signed the reciprocal easement and operating agreement, they were attempting to sign a document that would be applied to the development of the property in construction and consistent with the site plan on the construction?
As a general proposition, yes.
All right, and so that's the intent of the parties we're looking for in the contract when we're looking at interpreting the contract for summary judgment purposes. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but...
Then if there is a question about what is the definition of a pad site, why isn't that a fact question?
Well, first, I disagree with you that there is a question on that. Secondly, if there were, it would be ambiguous, and you would not have an ambiguous restriction on a party. You would favor free use of the property. If you're going to have a restriction, it has to be expressed and clear.
Well, I agree with you that we come to the idea down through the interpretation of contract construction till we get to the point of when we get through all of the cases you cited in the brief that we're still down to the question of free use of the property. But free use of the property can include a contract that determines how the property will be developed, can't it, Mr. Johnson? Free use of the property means the parties who own the property or when they're buying it or whenever they're setting up a construction plan have a free choice about adopting between themselves a reciprocal easement and operating agreement that would run with the land and would govern future activities on the land.
Your Honor, parties in Texas can enter into narrowly tailored specific restrictive covenants, and those can be enforced. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. That's my question of you, and I'm understanding that if that comes down to all of the logic that you've been addressing, it still comes to the question of what does this word pad site mean and what does it mean as to what is a minor as opposed to a major change in the site plan. We keep using the term ambiguity in terms of the terms of the contract. But an ambiguity, to me, fosters a fact question.
Well, Your Honor, in the context of restrictive covenants, if there's a fact question on the meaning of a word, it's ambiguous. It is not clear. It is not clear. And if it's not clear, you don't enforce it. Now, with regard to, okay, you have provisions. How do you give some meaning to them? The courts have done, A, by looking at the documents themselves, which I've just talked about.
Right.
B, you can look at... Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your answer because I've got a question about what you just said.
Okay, thank you. B, you can look at case law, which this court did in the Dygart opinion, and we have an opinion, Your Honors, attached in re state Langer, which is attached in our notebooks,
yes,
which gives a definition on page 7. It says, a pad site is a building site within a shopping area that is ready for construction of a retail establishment and is usually surrounded by customer parking areas. That's note 12. That doesn't say anything about the size of a building. It says exactly what I say. It's an area for development near a shopping center, period. This court can also look at dictionary.
Thank you for answering my question.
Let me ask you, that was a different case, and I think that generic description of what a pad site is may apply. Where in this contract, though, you mentioned a moment ago that you were pointing to some of the pad sites in this diagram, and you said that's what a pad site is, but where in the contract itself does it describe what the parties meant by pad site? Because the parties could very well have meant something different by pad site, by their use of the word pad site, than what we said in Dygart.
Well, Dygart didn't discuss the term pad site. To answer your question, this agreement does not have a definition. Pad site means area for construction near a shopping mall. It doesn't define it that way. But if you look at the site plan, attached to it, it says these are the pad sites. And we have two buildings that expressly has square footage in them and that are Vineyards properties, Vineyards pad sites. One is over 12,000, one is over 13,000 square feet.
Okay, so the way we determine what the parties meant by pad site in this case is looking at the way this diagram was drawn.
Yes.
The measurements used and so forth, and then we can determine from that. That's what you're saying. That's how we find out what a pad site is or what it was meant to be in this case.
Well, that is certainly one way.
There's no language in the contract itself that describes
right.
it.
Well, the issue is, does there nine this false conclusory 9,000-square-foot limitation on pad sites? There's nothing anywhere that says that other than Burke Collins' testimony. Does that somehow conflict with the plain, simple written agreement? Yes, it does. It conflicts because two of his own pad sites has well over the square footage he's testifying to. And square footage is similar to our building.
I guess I just feel, in a sense, Mr. Johnson, that what you're asking us to do is to step in the shoes of an expert or an engineer and determine, with this type of drawing, what the parties meant by pad site when they use that term here. And that's my only concern.
Well, I think my time is up. May I answer your question?
Not sure.
Mm-hmm. Pad site, this is what parties who try to create ambiguity do. They pick out a word and say, oh, well, this could mean this and this could mean that. And the cases in the state have, including the Hickory Ridge Homeowners Association under tab 8 in our notebook, the issue there was the word site, S-I-T-E, site. And the court there looked at a dictionary for what, and said, use common knowledge of what the word site is. And they look at the dictionary. And I provide under tab 9 five different definitions from dictionaries and encyclopedias that none of them have space limitations in them. And the court then says at the very end, we find the trial court properly applied the law of Texas and strictly construed the term site against the party seeking to enforce the restrictive covenant. That's what I'm talking about here. This court doesn't have to go into engineering. It doesn't have to have special expertise. They're the ones with the burden of proof to prove that this is a clear restriction that they're trying to impose on my client. And they haven't done that. They have not done that. And pad site doesn't mean what they say it means. The party's agreement itself expressly goes against what they're saying. May I briefly conclude?
The diagram, you mean, not the party's agreement, but the diagram itself goes against what they're saying.
Site plan is attached and incorporated into the party's agreement. I think it's all the same thing.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it.
Let me follow up with my colleague's discussion.
I was all ready to go here.
Pad site isn't capitalized.
Yes, sir.
It isn't defined. It's in small letters. In the portion referring to the three pad sites, it doesn't refer to the site plan. So I'm struggling that it is anything other than the generic meaning of the pad site, which is what I thought it was, and that in the case we just discussed, it's a site for a building generally associated with a shopping center. It doesn't have anything to do with 7,000 to 9,000 square feet or anything, particularly when confronted with your own pad sites, which exceed what your representative said that it meant. So help me out there.
I think I can. First of all, it's used four times in that paragraph. It means something. Four times. Secondly, this is extrinsic. This isn't part of the contract. This is a subsequent drawing. This is part of the contract. So
okay.
If you're considering this as the size limitation over here, you're considering extrinsic evidence to interpret the contract. This was attached. This is the site plan attached.
Okay.
So starting there. Secondly, there is no size limitation in that REA as it relates to those out parcel developments on the pad sites.
Okay.
So where is it? I think it's in the term pad site. That's what I think it means. If I am wrong on my interpretation, I think I've created a fact question, at the very least, that a fact finder is entitled to determine, not the trial court on summary judgment. Last, I think the argument you're hearing from Mr. Johnson is a waiver argument. That's entirely fact sensitive. He's saying your client did it this way, therefore my client can do it this way. Well, that has nothing to do with the interpretation of the contract. That has to do with extrinsic evidence as it relates to development on the ground after the fact, not what the parties intended. The trial court didn't even allow us to put in surrounding circumstances, which is appropriate to understand the nature of which the dealings with the parties were dealing with at the time they entered into the contract. Certainly, he eliminated by a general objection to parole evidence, specific testimony as relates to what we meant by pad site, other evidence in an affidavit he struck. But he did leave it in enough. I think our definition of pad site is in there. There are two distinct definitions of pad site. I want to move to your other question, Your Honor, because I think it's important for me to give you a specific site as it relates to your question about compliance. And I want you to look at paragraph 4 because I think it's important of the REA. Because when you say, is the right to build 4 superseding, right to build 3 superseding the consent provision. And if you look at the two sentences that follow the first sentence, the second sentence says, this shall include. I mean, a reasonable reading of that is that this next provision incorporates what's before it. And then the next sentence, which deals with the 4 instead of 3, or the 3 instead of 4, says, additionally. I think a reasonable construction of those paragraphs say, consider all this together. This shall include, additionally. You have to read this harmoniously with a liberal construction because paragraph 29 says it must be. I think that's a reasonable interpretation of that paragraph, that consent provision applies to everything in there. I think a reasonable interpretation, it applies to anything you do differently than the site plan. Your Honor, on...
Even if the contract itself allows or provides for the change, the revision that...
I think it would be totally improper. Well, totally. You couldn't withhold consent. It's just a notice, basically, at that point. I still think the owner's entitled to notice of changes. I mean, he has a lot more. This owner has a lot more at stake in this development than that.
But does the contract provide for notice of any changes?
That's what I think the consent becomes if you're in conformity.
Actually, the contract doesn't express in an affirmative way that any consent is supposed to be sought. We're looking at
I think you're right.
Inferring from the negative words with unreasonably withhold that there's a duty to provide some type of notice.
I agree with you, and I prefer the language that's the other way, but I still think it has the same effect as it relates to the party's contract here. But I think any change, minor change, would require consent, but I think if it's in conformity, it just becomes basically a notice at that point.
But if the parties provided for the change that was made, why would there need to be additional consent given if they already agreed to it to begin with?
That's what the parties intended, because that's what the contract says. I don't know why I'm not in their shoes, but that's what they put in there. Last thing, Your Honor, I wanted to turn to what you said, Justice Casey, earlier question. I would point you to paragraph 18 of the Univest pleading. I think that's where they seek the declaratory relief. And I think going back to your question whether or not certain findings can be inferred, I think that's where I'd point you to, because their prayer for relief has nothing in it. It just says everything we asked for. So you look at paragraph 18, I think clearly they have not asked for the type of relief that you suggest the court could have inferentially made a determination on. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Sanders. Appreciate all of you coming here this morning to present your arguments. They're well done and very helpful. The case is submitted, and you're all excused.